This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Among the many pieces of legislation moving through legislative channels this year are two that deal with the sex offender registry. One was already passed and signed into law. It requires offenders to register with the state before their release rather than shortly after. The other one still in play aims to improve the accuracy of the registry. Democratic State Senator Dick Sears is one of the sponsors.
Two audits by two different auditors of accounts both showed tremendous problems with the sex offender registry in terms of accuracy. So we're hopeful that these changes will improve the accuracy of the registry.
Those two audits showed rates of so-called critical errors over 10%. People on the list who shouldn't have been or not on the list who should have. In a few minutes, we're going to talk with the head of the Vermont Crime Information Center. It runs the sex offender registry and has a lot of other responsibilities as well. But before we get to that, we're going to check in with Alan Gilbert, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Vermont. He has concerns not only about the errors in the registry, but about listing sex offenders online at all. Alan, nice to have you back on the program.
Hi, thanks for having me, Jane.
What is the ACLU's position on how to make the sex offender registry more accurate?
We, first of all, don't believe that sex offender online sex offender registries are effective in protecting public safety. So let me just start there. Assuming there is going to be an online registry, however, what we've worked for in S13 is to minimize the errors that can possibly be contained and still have information posted, and to make absolutely sure that if an offender's home address is to be posted, that all information about that offender be accurate.
And how would you like to see that happen? Through manual checks from the Vermont Crime Information Center, from somebody else?
No, the checking will be done through the Crime Information Center. They're responsible for making sure the information is correct once they've been given it by, in the bill, says they'll get the information from the court eventually. So they get the information, then they have to check to make sure it's still accurate, and much of the responsibility is on the offender to notify the Crime Information Center of a change in address. It can be hard to make sure that all happens, and that's why we think the information really does have to be correct and there has to be verification by the center that it is.
Alan Gilbert, you mentioned that you're starting from a position of thinking that there should be no public online sex offender registry. Why not?
There was a study in 2005 done by a legislative committee that looked at this issue, and it determined that there is no evidence that online registries work. However, the legislative study committee said the public wants this information. It is public information. Therefore, the legislature will have it published on an online registry.
And when you say that the study showed that the registries don't work, you mean to enhance public safety?
That's correct. There's no evidence that public safety is enhanced by posting information about sex offenders online.
And from your position, what's the harm of having that registry online?
It creates a target for people. There have been some unfortunate cases, including one in Maine in 2006, I believe it was, where two sex offenders were targeted by a man who came down from New Brunswick in Canada. He wanted to literally kill some sex offenders. He looked at sex offender registries online for Maine, New Hampshire, and actually Vermont, chose two offenders in Maine, went down and killed them at their residences. The addresses were there. Then he himself was killed by police while he was riding the bus to get to Boston after the crimes.
So your point is that these sex offenders who are registered online and their names and towns at least are available to the public to see, that they are put at risk?
They're put at risk. Their families, if they do have families living there, or other people who are in the home, are put at risk. The really awful thing would be is if the information were not correct and the sex offender no longer lived at that address, but the address hadn't been updated. Meanwhile, somebody else had moved into the house. A vigilante who comes to that address thinking there's a sex offender there he wants to kill could involve a completely innocent person with tragic results.
Alan Gilbert, it doesn't seem like it's going to be an easy sell to the public to say we'd like to get rid of the sex offender registry.
It never has been. Since the online registry was created in 2004, we have not succeeded in convincing people. It really is a waste of valuable resources to be spending our money this way to try to protect the public, because it doesn't seem to really do that.
Alan Gilbert is Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Vermont. Thanks very much for sharing your perspective with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We're going to turn now to the director of the state division in charge of the Sex Offender Registry. So listeners, if you have questions about how it works, who gets on it, how long they have to be on, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Jeffrey Wallen is director of the Vermont Crime Information Center. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Jane.
The two audits done 4 years apart that we mentioned right at the top of the show showed that there were some critical errors in the online sex offender registry. The one in 2014 showed that all but one of the records that were randomly pulled had some error on it, maybe just a misspelling of a person's name or some small error, but 10% had what were deemed critical errors. So people who were on the list who shouldn't have been on the list, or as I said, people who weren't on the list who should have been on the list. Given the high stakes that Alan Gilbert was just talking about, why are there so many errors?
The errors that show up on the registry come from a number of places, and the single largest issue is the information that is fed into the registry comes from a number of different places, and it can be very challenging to collate that data when you may receive something from two different sources that's very closely timed, but it doesn't match. And so try to pull that information together can be very challenging. We were also hamstrung previously by the fact that the information technology underlying the registry was very outdated. And when the most recent audit came through, we were in the middle of updating that to a much more automatic and a system that had a lot more functionality than what we had had before.
You switched over to an IT system that was actually designed for sex offender registries. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. We went with a company. We received a federal grant to go out and update our systems, and they specifically design technology systems that work with offender management. So
do you believe that if an audit were done today, some of those issues would be fixed?
Absolutely. A number of those issues would no longer be issues. And we were upfront with the auditor's office when they came in that one particular issue that related to how long individuals were going to be listed on the registry was a technical issue that we were working through. Every state has a unique set of laws and requirements around registry requirements. So when they come in and work with a new state, there's often a development period that has to happen. And we were in the middle of that period with the software company, the IT company we were using. And when they came in and spent some time with us, the auditor's office did, we realized or had realized, excuse me, that there was an area that was going to take some working out. And they noted that in their report, but it still showed up as a number of critical errors because it was showing at the time individuals' length of registration was incorrect.
When you say that the information is coming in from many different sources and it's hard to make sure that it's all verified, can you talk a little bit about what those sources are and how you get the information?
Well, certainly. Information comes from a number of different places. One, the courts. The courts provide information to us. Also, the Department of Corrections and the various parole and probation offices around the state provide information to us. The offenders themselves are another significant source of information coming through. So when you're trying to collate information from the courts and the Department of Corrections and the offenders talking to us directly, you can often, again, you find collating that data can be challenging, particularly if it all comes in a short period of time and it was perhaps all accurate or they're all looking at different parts of the data and trying to make it all line up correctly and collate correctly can be challenging.
What happens if there are discrepancies? Is it your job or your staff's job to go out and find what is actually accurate?
Well, that would be the step. If we're receiving information, for example, if we have two different documents that show a different release date for an individual, we then have to try to track down, well, what is the accurate release date? And that slows the process up because we try to get that right. We certainly strive to get that right, but it means a delay in getting that individual in and accurately placed on the registry.
And by release date, you mean release from prison, not release from the registry?
I know, correct. And that release from either from prison, as you said, or what is perhaps more critical is release from supervision of probation and parole, because that starts their clock. Individuals that are on the registry for a 10-year period, it's from when they're released from supervision, not necessarily when they're released from prison or from jail. And getting that date correct can be challenging, and getting that information to come in. So,
and that was something that the audit found, that sometimes people were on the registry who were in fact still in jail or still on probation and within the Department of Corrections control.
Correct.
And so those are still system errors that are difficult for you?
Well, I wouldn't say they're system errors. They're information errors, where we receive something that says the individual is being released on X date, but they actually aren't being released on X date. And so we have received information and we're accurately representing that information, but the entity that provided it to us may have made an error somewhere. So we are working certainly always with our partners, corrections, specifically probation and parole and courts, to try to update and automate how we're doing this. Right now, a lot of it is still manual. We've come a long way, but we certainly are looking to continue to automate this. The fewer hands you have touching the information as it moves through, the more time you spend troubleshooting these issues and the less time just relaying data from one computer system to the other.
Again, today we're talking with the head of the Vermont Crime Information Center, Jeffrey Wallen. One of the things the VCIC does is maintain the sex offender registry, and we're spending a little bit of time on that. It's been in the news lately. We're looking at what's actually contained in the registry, what kinds of offenses people have committed that would get them on the sex offender registry, and for how long. And if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Jeff Wallen, that question about what kinds of offenses will get someone listed on the sex offender registry, that's changed over time. What gets somebody on the public registry? Right now, what are the crimes?
Well, there's a significant list, and I won't try to run through all of them. But some of the most common ones we see are sexual assault, lewd and lascivious conduct with a child, sexual exploitation of a child, or if we see individuals that have what we would call a straight lewd and lascivious conduct, but they're repeat offenders. So they have more than one conviction at different times. So that will cause someone to go on the registry. And those are some of the most common things that we do see that qualify individuals for registry inclusion.
And someone who may have committed a sexual offense but who wouldn't be on the registry? On the public registry?
Some of those things, the convictions that come through are often for things like prohibited acts, and that really comes to us. We only receive the information from the courts as to what the conviction is. We often don't get into the what did they actually do or didn't do, because the statute that governs this is all around conviction information, so we just receive and review conviction information as it comes through.
And a prohibited act, you mean something that... Like what?
Well, there's specific within the statute, there's a whole category of prohibited acts. But for example, someone could potentially expose themselves. Oftentimes, an individual may be arrested for something more serious, like a lewd and lascivious conduct charge. And as through the court process, it gets pled down to, or the individual gets convicted of a prohibited act. And so we ultimately just receive that conviction information. And very rarely do we get into what did they actually do, because it doesn't. It's not often germane to registry status. It's their conviction qualification.
Also, my understanding is a juvenile offender who is tried in juvenile court may not be on the public registry.
Correct.
And how long does somebody stay on the registry?
Individuals stay on the registry right now in one of two categories. They're either 10 years, and again, that's 10 years from when they're released from probation and parole supervision, or lifetime. And if an individual is convicted of sexual assault or aggravated sexual assault, if they're a repeat offender, or there's a few other categories as well, including if they're not compliant with treatment, they'll be on there for life. If they don't fall into that qualification or into one of those categories, then they're required to register for 10 years.
So one of the things that you just mentioned is that there's still a lot of manual inputting of information, and you'd like to get things more automated so that there are fewer hands on it. When you're talking about manually inputting information, is it just a sense of, I have a piece of paper in front of me, I need to put in into the registry, into the system, what's on this piece of paper? Or are there things that people on your staff have to look at and determine themselves whether or not this person should be on the registry?
Well, Jane, that's a great question, and it's both. It's really both. To speak to the first question, we will receive an email or a fax or a scan of a document from a probation office or from some other entity that will have the individual's information on it, and typically because that's a scan or an email that doesn't get automatically loaded anywhere. It has to be manually entered into the system. And we are certainly working and have continuing conversations with the Department of Corrections on, is there a way we can get this stuff to come over in a data transfer capacity? That reduces the errors. It also allows us to do more automated checking, and it speeds up the process. There is, however, having said that, still determinations that have to be made. Right now, we do get conviction information that come over from the courts. We have to determine whether or not the individual qualifies for listing on the registry, and that's one of the things in the bill that you had mentioned earlier that's going through the legislature right now that would put that responsibility on the courts and allow the individual full access rights and responsibilities to the court process so they know what's going on, they understand what their requirements are going to be, and they have a chance to speak to that along with defense counsel, and the same thing for the state to present their case as well. So that would move that for Vermont conviction outside of our area, and it's something we certainly support. Having said that, there's always going to be the individuals from out of state. And if an individual is convicted of an offense in New Hampshire or Idaho or wherever it might be, and they move into Vermont, we have to analyze that individual's conviction to find out what is the most equivalent or most similar conviction in Vermont, and then does that require them to register? If so, how long, and what are their reporting requirements? So that is a manual process.
So you support the idea that the courts should have the ultimate jurisdiction on deciding who should be on the registry and who shouldn't. You don't feel proprietary ownership of that information and that task?
Absolutely not. We certainly don't feel that way. Again, it having this process done through the courts really provides the individual in question the full gamut of their rights and responsibilities and all the assistance and counsel they're entitled to as well.
And when your staff does have to make a determination, how are they trained to do that?
Right now, it's a very collaborative process. We have one full-time staff member who works with the registry, and then myself and others within the department will support them as necessary and able. And so we'll go through and look, and we often do have to sit down and just spend time looking through statutes, looking through language, try to determine what is equivalent or not. We may have to ask questions of others, bring in different opinions to determine what needs to go on here and what doesn't. From a technical perspective, we work with our vendor on continued training. We're always looking for new training opportunities, how to use the system better. One of the examples that I often think of is it's very easy to purchase a computer system and it turns into you buy a mansion and you're living in the kitchen. You can get everything you need to do done, but there's probably other functionality that may be there or could be developed. And so the vendor that we work with has been very responsive on new ideas and, well, could we do this or can we look at that or how about moving in this direction? And they're certainly responsive to that.
When you talk about how you guys all have to get together and figure out, what the right thing to do is, I can imagine some people thinking, I don't understand where the gray area is. You're either a sex offender or you're not, so you should either be on the registry or not. Can you give me an example of what you're talking about that would take some analysis or some determination by somebody on your staff to figure that out?
Well, certainly. I think the easiest case is, again, to talk about an individual coming from out of state. So if you look at someone coming from New Hampshire, let's say that is convicted of a sexual assault crime in New Hampshire, that may or may not be, and in this particular case, very well likely may not be analogous to what we would call sexual assault in Vermont. Every state has different statutes, and they use different terminology to frame actions or events. And so we say, okay, the individual is convicted of this charge in New Hampshire. We have that information. And then we look at that language to see what were they convicted of and then try to figure out within Vermont what's that most analogous to. And there's almost never a direct, oh, it's exactly the same wording. It's exactly the same thing. They just call it something different. So we have to figure out where that equivalency equivalency lies. And sometimes it's a fairly straightforward, I will say, you know, you have to look at it, but it's a fairly straightforward process. Other times it requires a great deal of discovery. We often have to go back to the state in question and ask for additional information. What were the elements of the crime that may not be listed in the statute? Because it does matter in Vermont. It doesn't matter in the other state. And that can take a fair amount of time, to analyze.
We got a note from Lee in Brattleboro who says, 3 to 5 years ago, the sex offender registry had many more people listed, 2 to 3 times more. And suddenly it was revamped and had far fewer offenders. Why did that happen? Is that true?
Well, I don't have numbers directly in front of me. I do know over the last several years, the number of active registrants has remained fairly static. It's right around the 1300 to 1400 number of active registrants. We have another 800 to 900 individuals that are in some other status. They may be incarcerated. There may be pending. So we've received some information, but we haven't received all of it yet, or their clock hasn't started, or they're inactive. They've moved out of state, but we still have some information on them because they may come back to Vermont during their registration period. So we have some information on those individuals. But to my knowledge, we haven't seen a, certainly not to that level, a change one way or the other. Oftentimes what we find is in discussing this, because there are different pieces of the puzzle, that one individual or one query may ask for a specific number, like the total number of individuals that you have any information on is different than the number of individuals that are actively on the registry and actively being engaged. And certainly in looking through various audit reports, there are different numbers and they're accurate, but you have to make sure you understand exactly what you're looking at. So without knowing the specific numbers that our query is referring to, that would be my best assumption, is that we're looking at kind of apples and oranges there.
And if Lee were to go online now and go to the sex offender registry, what would Lee see?
Well, Lee would see right now we have approximately 1,200 individuals that are listed on the online registry. Again, that number varies daily because individuals may move, come on and off, or we receive updated information on there. And it shows their name. It has their most recent photo. Individuals, offenders are required to provide a photo once a year. It will have the conviction or convictions, their qualifying convictions. Now, if they have other, if they have traffic tickets, DUIs, that's not going to show up. It's just qualifying sex convictions that show up. It's going to show their town and county of residence and state, obviously. It's going to show that information. And also, if they have a warrant out for their arrest, if they're not treatment compliant or they're not compliant with the registry requirements. So it's going to have a fair amount of information on the individuals, on each individual's is online.
And as of right now, no street addresses, because we're waiting for the sex offender registry to show many fewer inaccuracies before that goes live.
That is correct. It just shows city and county.
We're talking with Jeffrey Wallen. He's the director of the Vermont Crime Information Center. We've been learning a little bit more about the sex offender registry, but that's just one of the things the VCIC is in charge of. When we come back, we're going to look at some of the other responsibilities, including the marijuana registry and how the VCIC oversees the medical marijuana dispensaries in the state. If you have questions about that, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Jeffrey Wallen. He's the director of the Vermont Crime Information Center. We've been hearing about one of the high-profile functions of the VCIC, maintaining the sex offender registry. That's been problematic for the center over the years. But there are other functions of the center as well, including monitoring the medical marijuana dispensaries that opened within the last couple years and keeping the list of patients who are allowed to legally obtain medical marijuana. We're going to talk with Jeff Wallen about those things right now as we learn a little bit more about this little-known arm of state government. And perhaps you have had a background check run on you by an employer or by a school. Maybe you're a foster parent and you've gone through this. That's done through this center as well. If you have questions about what's happening in the background when that is going on, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Jeff, your office has had to keep a list of the patients who are eligible to obtain medical marijuana, either by growing it themselves or having a proxy, or now by getting it from a medical marijuana dispensary that's registered with the state, and the patients have decided or delineated or been assigned to one of those dispensaries. Is it more complicated to be managing the dispensaries than it was to manage the list of patients who were eligible to get medical marijuana?
Well, certainly the overall management of the program has changed, and probably the easiest way to indicate that to folks listening is just to very quickly look at a number. In 2006, we had a total of 30 patients on the registry, and as the most recent pull of numbers this year, we had 1,754. So that right there, just the scale increasing, and we saw the biggest increase during that period was when the dispensaries came online. Before then, individuals could grow it on their own or they could obtain it some other way, and that's literally as much as we could ever say about it. With the dispensaries now, individuals had a way that was not state-run, but the state provided oversight. The department provides oversight to the dispensaries. They operate within a set of rules both set forth in statute and also by the program. And individuals could go and purchase up to 2 ounces of usable product per 30-day period. And so we saw really a big increase there. And that's really created where a lot of the complexity came in. Secondarily to that, we've seen a change in the qualifying conditions and the language that allows someone to be on the registry. And much of that has been gradual. We have seen a few significant changes through the years. But really, it's the single biggest driver in the challenges of overseeing that program have come from the increasing numbers.
And so that's just a volume question, the number of people on the registry who can obtain medical marijuana.
Correct.
And I think, you know, you mentioned that the only way is before the dispensaries people could grow their own or something else. But I think the something else also included they were allowed to designate one specified person if they were incapacitated who could be their sort of grower on their behalf. And were you keeping track of those designees?
Those individuals are what are termed as caregivers. And so an individual who is a patient could have a caregiver who could grow for them and provide that to them. But that was a one-to-one relationship. You couldn't have a caregiver that provided for 5 patients.
Right.
It was a one-to-one relationship.
You also, I understand, have to monitor, keep an eye on the dispensaries themselves.
That's correct, yes.
What do you do?
Well, there's a significant amount of work that goes into with the dispensaries. The way the statutes around this are set up is it does require that individual patients select which dispensary they want to use, and that dispensary may only serve those individuals that have indicated. So it's a lock-in process, and that's done for a number of reasons. Primarily, again, it's a diversion issue. We don't want people going around to all 4 in one day trying to purchase more product than they need, and then all of a sudden you have a potential diversion issue. So there's a lot of communication that happens on a very regular basis between the program and the dispensaries, who their qualified patients are, when someone comes off, doesn't renew, if they want to change their dispensary selection. There's a significant amount of information there. Past that, there are scheduled reviews for security records. I review their grow operations to make sure they're within the parameters. We also review their sales audits. The staff of the registry staff review their sales records to make sure that they're not allowing someone to come in and purchase more than the 2 ounces in a 30-day period, and that they're following all the rules, including having a sliding fee scale in place for individuals.
That sounds like a lot of work.
It is. It is a lot of work.
Did you get a lot of extra money from the state to take that on?
That's a good question. We did not get any additional money from the state to bring that on. However, the fees that both patients, but primarily the dispensaries pay, they pay a licensing fee, for lack of a better term, to the department every year. And that money is what funds the program. So there is at this point no general fund money that is siphoned off to support the program. It's a completely self-sustaining program.
And when you say they pay, those dispensaries pay money to the department, you're under the Department of Public Safety.
Correct. Yes.
So what is the size of your staff and what is your budget?
Well, the size of the staff, we have 2 full-time individuals right now that work in the registry and that work in the marijuana registry. And they, again, they do oversight of the dispensaries, primary day-to-day oversight of the dispensaries, answering questions, and then processing the applications. The applications are not we just receive a piece of paper and then mail out an ID card. We have to receive that information, receive the digital photo because the identification cards that are produced have a photo on them, again, to enhance security. We then contact the physician or the healthcare provider's office to make sure that that is their patient, that they meet all the requirements, including, generally speaking, at least a 6-month relationship, that they have a qualifying condition, et cetera. The individual is a licensed healthcare provider, et cetera. And that's all manual. There's no way to, you can't just do a quick Google search and okay, you're good. You have to actually call the physician's office and verify that. So those 2 staff people do that. They also answer the phone, people calling in with questions. around them, and providing outreach to the community as well. Just recently at the cancer conference that was held in Burlington, you know, they went and provided a discussion panel and answered questions from folks at that as well. As far as the actual overall budget, I don't have that specific number in front of me. But
well, what about your overall for the whole center? What's your budget?
Overall, the whole center, we don't have a specific budget, partly because we are different units that function under, and our budgets are collated up under the Department of Public Safety. So we do have dedicated lines, but we receive grant funding from the federal government to enhance some of our operations. Not this particular one we're talking about right now, but as we mentioned during the sex offender registry discussions, we received some federal money and continue to at times receive federal money to help upgrade that program, and also our criminal history operations. We receive funding as well.
Do you know how much comes from the general fund for all of your operations?
Off the top of my head, I don't have that number, unfortunately.
And how many staff members do you have for the entire center? You know, two for the marijuana registry. What about overall?
For overall, we have right now we have 12 full-time staff, a couple of vacancies that come and go at any given time. But that really looks at a wide range of areas that we're involved in, not only the marijuana registry and the sex offender registry, but our criminal history information, our crime statistics, our wanted and missing, and then all of our fingerprint operations are managed within there as well.
Do you need more money and more staff to do the job of the Crime Information Center accurately and well?
Do we need more money and staff? We can always certainly use more resources. I'm never going to say no to that question. We could certainly always use more resources. Some areas, the sex offender registry being a good example of one that really does strain given the requirements. Others we feel like run fairly well within their provided requirements. But certainly we're always looking and advocating for more resources, and not simply as a matter of asking for it, but quite simply that in order to do our job as effectively and respond as quickly as possible to the public needs of the public, to be able to do that as best as we can.
Yeah, you mentioned some of the other things that your staff does, and I mentioned them as well. If you're getting a background check, if it's a law enforcement officer running a background check on you, that's separate. But your center does things like schools that need to run background checks, or potential employers, or I came in contact with a background check when I wanted a visa to study abroad. You run those kinds of background checks, and the fingerprint registry, and then you also keep crime statistics, right?
That's correct, yes.
So what do you like about your job, Jeff?
What do I like about my job is it's certainly never the same thing twice. It is very rewarding to be in a position where you're bringing individuals together from different areas of expertise, because in many states, these functions are all completely separate. They're in different buildings, different departments, different parts of the state where these are done. In Vermont, we all work in one building, essentially, and work together and try to collaborate. And also, when you can help someone who is trying to complete their foreign adoption paperwork and they're struggling with what to do and they need to get this background check done, helping them through that process. When someone had saying, that's not me, I wasn't convicted of that back in 1974, helping them figure out how to challenge that and how to question that. So those are the things I think that we enjoy the most.
That's Jeffrey Wallen. He's director of the Vermont Crime Information Center. Thank you for telling us about what goes on at the VCIC.
Well, thank you, Jane.
Coming up, we'll talk with UVM hockey goalie Brody Hoffman. He's skipping his senior year to go pro, but he's got some realistic expectations about what his life is going to be like. We'll hear more next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The storied history of the University of Vermont hockey program has turned out a number of players who've made it to the National Hockey League. Among them is one goaltender who stands out. Tim Thomas went on to play with three NHL clubs, and he lifted the Stanley Cup in 2011 as a member of the Boston Bruins. Now there's another UVM netminder who hopes to follow in Thomas's footsteps, Brody Hoffman. The Saskatchewan native has decided to forego his senior year at UVM to sign with the Minnesota Wild. We were curious why he wanted to go pro now instead of waiting till after he graduated.
I had a good end to the season, and it's something that's kind of been in the works for a while. So I put myself in a position academically that moving forward, the plan is to still get my degree. But as a 24-year-old, you want to take that step because you only have a certain window that you're able to play.
So given that, why did you go to college at all?
It was a good opportunity. I needed the growth, and there's a lot of exposure in the NCAA and especially Hockey East. It was a step up from the junior that I was playing, so I was able to improve and get noticed at this level.
So if you're 24 now and you felt like, all right, I better jump and take this opportunity, What advantage or disadvantage do you think your age provides you in heading into the pros?
As a goalie, I think generally the learning curve is a little longer. So as a 24-year-old goalie, I think it's kind of a good age. There's some older guys breaking into the league this year, like Andrew Hammond and Scott Darling. As a player, you generally see younger guys that kind of break through, but goalies take a little longer. It's a little more seasoning and stuff like that. So I think it's a good age for me to step into the pro level.
So 24 isn't a problem then to be just starting out now?
I don't think so. I think it's maybe teetering, though. If you get to be 25 or 26 and haven't started yet, or you're just coming out of school, then teams might look to a younger guy.
Brody, why Minnesota? Why'd you sign with them?
It seems like a great organization. Obviously, all NHL teams have great organizations, but Midwestern feel Minnesota is a great hockey market, and they just moved their AHL team to Iowa. They have a great facility there, a good fan base, so I'm excited for the opportunity.
You mentioned their AHL team in Iowa, and it's probably unlikely, although one can dream, that you'll go straight to Minnesota next year. Can you explain a little bit how the farm system works for people who maybe aren't familiar with it and where you hope to end up this coming season?
Yeah, the main team's in Minnesota, obviously, and then the American League is the next level below, and Minnesota has their team in Des Moines, Iowa. And then there's also a league below that, the East Coast Hockey League. They have their team in Alaska, I believe. So you start in main camp in Minnesota, and if you're lucky enough to make the team, then you stick there. Or then they send you down and you start camp again in Iowa. And the plan is to make that team. I'd like to play in the American League next year because, as you said, it'd be a really big leap to go straight to the NHL. And then if you don't stick with Iowa, you go to Alaska and you'd play with the East Coast League team there. And I'm on a two-way deal, so that just means I can go up and down amongst the three teams without having to clear waivers or anything like that.
And you're hoping to be in Iowa?
Yeah, that's the plan. Obviously, it's a big step from college, but I'm hoping to put in the work this summer and make the team in Iowa.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference you think you'll find between college play and the pros, even just the jump between America East and then the AHL?
Yeah, from Hockey East to the American League, it'll definitely be a quicker game. Bigger guys, the plays will just develop faster, so I have to work on my footwork and reading plays and stuff like that, so I'm anticipating what's going to happen. But I think it's kind of a fine line, though. Guys are so good at this level that they kind of break through, and it might not be a big jump in some ways, but it'll definitely be a faster game.
Faster, so that's where the footwork's going to really come into play.
Yeah, I think so. For me, I'm a big guy, so if I'm able to keep up with the play and stay square, I'm usually in a pretty good spot.
So if everything goes as you hope it to, how soon do you think you could make it to Minnesota?
That's a tough call. I mean, to stick would obviously take some time. I have a lot of learning to do. I'm excited to start working with the goalie coaches in Minnesota and stuff like that. But you never know, because if a guy gets injured or something, you might be an emergency call up and you might get a game or two. But I don't see it happening next year, or maybe even the year after. It'll take some time, but that's definitely the goal.
I know you're now leaving UVM, but let's go back to your decision a few years ago to come to UVM in the first place. What made it the right school for you?
I like the look of the city. I actually didn't have a chance to visit, but I did a lot of research online looking into the school and the city. And I'm from a really small town in Saskatchewan, so Burlington was a smaller city. It didn't seem too overwhelming. There wasn't the big financial district or anything like that. And I don't mind being outdoors and stuff, so the thought of Vermont, it was a nice place to live. You can kind of get away from school, get out away from the hustle and bustle, so I thought it'd be a good fit for me.
And were you right?
Yeah, it was great. It was probably the best 3 years of my life. I couldn't have gotten much more out of the experience. Maybe would have liked to win a couple more games, you know, still be playing, but it was definitely a good decision.
You know, we hear a lot about how difficult it is for D1 athletes, particularly in the big football and basketball schools, to focus on both academics and their team pursuits. How are you able to do that? And do you think you're being successful at it?
I think so. Being as close as I am to my degree, that was a goal. And the promise I made to my mom is that I will finish at some point. But I think organization and time management's a big thing. If you have a weekend without games or stuff like that, you definitely have to be working hard, because when playoffs roll around, you're you're leaving Burlington on Wednesday or Thursday, so you missed two and a half days of class. So try to develop a relationship with the professors, make sure they're understanding of your situation, but you definitely have to stay organized.
But I can remember from my brief playing days in college that you can't always take the classes you might want to take. You might not be able to major in what you'd be majoring in if you weren't an athlete.
I was lucky enough to get into the business school, which was my goal. I concentrated in accounting, which I was also able to stay in. But as you said, the coaches give you your schedule for workouts and practices, and then it's kind of your responsibility to make your school schedule around that. They have some leeway for seniors and stuff, but if you're just in introductory classes, they generally make you switch out if it conflicts with hockey.
So if you don't wind up making millions in the NHL, what's your plan?
Hopefully by the end of my playing career, I'll have my degree through summer courses and online courses. And then I'm majoring in accounting, so something to do with that, maybe cap management or something in sports. I think that'd be pretty cool, or get into financial stuff.
So you might have to wind up in one of those cities with a big financial district after all.
Yeah, I might. I don't know. We'll see.
What's one memory you're going to take from your time with the Catamounts?
Probably my biggest memory on the ice was beating Boston College this year. I was kind of going through a tough stretch and got a chance to play in the playoffs there and played pretty well. And we were able to beat Boston College, which we hadn't done before. So that was big, not only for me, but for the program.
Before I let you go, what music do you listen to before you have a big game to get yourself pumped up?
Yeah, I mix it up. I have there's some country to kind of ease the mood. There's lots of Eric Church on there.
Well, Brody Hoffman, good luck next season, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Damn, I used to love this view. Sit here and drink a few. Main Street in the high school. Up on Friday night, down there it's another touchdown. Man, this year's team is stout. I can hear him going crazy. And up here so
that's a little Eric Church in honor of Brody Hoffman. It's called Give Me Back My Hometown. We often continue to get comments from listeners about Vermont Edition long after the broadcast ends, and that was the case in yesterday's program about problems with Vermont's healthcare exchange. Producer Rick Sangari joins me now to read a couple of those messages. Hey, Rick.
Hola, Jane. We were discussing the state auditor's report on what went wrong with Vermont Health Connect. The audit found significant shortcomings in building the exchange from contractors in the state, and a listener commenting as a whipped donkey wrote, as someone who worked on the project from the very beginning, there were significant issues on both sides with regards to how the project was managed. The state was unwilling to realize that 10 months was not enough time for the requirements we were given, and CGI was utilizing an outdated project management methodology for the project. Some of the requirements were so vague as to be considered not implementable. The technology solution was not fully baked and poorly designed. Tack on the fact that third-party resources were not nearly ready for us on October 1st, and, well, that's what happened.
And a user perspective, B. Fryer posted, Vermont Health Connect is the most Kafkaesque system imaginable. I joined early as a believer in socialized medicine, and this thing practically turned me into a Republican. It is labyrinthine and idiotic, as if run by gerbils. I only got help when I threatened to write a big article about it in a major business magazine. This is Exhibit A of how not to run a government system. Unlike, unbelievable.
And Mark posts to that same discussion thread, if, as Auditor Doug Hoffer suggested, Vermont Health Connect was built with the assumption of a Vermont single-payer plan coming into play by 2017, then it makes the decision by Governor Shumlin to pull the plug on single-payer all that much worse. Now tens of thousands of Vermonters are stuck in this morass without even the possibility of something better in two more years. Nice job, Governor.
Some harsh comments there for Vermont Health Connect. All right, moving on to another topic. Last week, we discussed the water quality bill the legislature is working on to improve the condition of Lake Champlain. Paul writes, it's clear to me that the legislature wants to appear that they're addressing this problem, but they're between a rock and a hard place. If they do what needs to be done, they'll put more stress on an industry that is barely treading water financially. I'm referring to the majority of farms in Vermont. To do the right thing here would increase costs greatly and make our our farms less competitive. Additionally, those legislators would never win another election. I feel certain that the current agricultural practices are contributing greatly to polluting and spoiling our waterways. But how would you address the issues of the costs involved to farmers in making such a dramatic change?
And we're still hearing from bird enthusiasts about our annual spring bird migration show. John wrote, "I heard this broadcast on my way to go skiing. As soon as I was done skiing, I went home and cleaned out our bluebird house. The next morning, I was excited to see our first cardinal of the year. Thanks for getting me excited about the birds."
Oh, you're welcome, John. And thanks to all of you who write to us with your reactions to the show and interact with each other and us on our social media and discussion forums. By the way, as you know, you can always email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Rick, thanks.
My pleasure, Jane.
All right, and that wraps up today's show. Tomorrow, divesting from fossil fuels. There's been a push to get colleges, states, and other organizations with big portfolios to sell off the stocks they own in companies that produce dirty energy. But that might actually work against an organization's financial mission, and it could help the energy companies it's designed to harm. We're going to tease apart that issue tomorrow at noon, and if you want to weigh in on fossil fuel divestment, tell us where you stand. Again, write to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Devin Karambulis. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.